Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
Jamie Ford is the New York Times best-selling author of Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet, which was a national and international sensation. In fact, it was translated into 35 languages. It was named the number one book club pick for 2009-2010 by the American Booksellers Association.
His second novel, Songs of Willow Frost, was published in 2013, and his latest novel, Love and Other Consolation Prizes, was just published in September. Ford lives in Great Falls with his wife, and I hear, Jamie, that you now are an empty nester. You had six teenagers fly the coop, is that right?
Oh, yeah, we are total empty nesters as of, you know, like 5 weeks ago.
Oh.
And oddly enough, my youngest, Lucas, is at Concordia in Minnesota, and I'm speaking at his college next week.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, he sent me a Snapchat of my giant face on this banner at his college, and he's just like, stop stalking me, Dad.
So no matter where they go, there you are.
Yeah, I'm following them.
So do you think you're going to be more prolific with having more time to write?
I think I'm going to be more prolific for a bunch of reasons. And less about timing, more about discipline. I worked with a director in Hollywood this summer on a screenwriting project, and she showed me kind of a technique she uses for creating an emotional outline. And I'm not a super disciplined outliner, but when we went through this process, I'm like, okay, I'm totally stealing this idea because there's a lot of utility in it. So hopefully I'll be faster and more prolific for all kinds of reasons.
Well, you've been very prolific in a few short years, actually, having three big books.
three books in 8 or 9 years. I mean, that's a pretty good pace, but I still feel a little weird compared to other authors who crank out a book every other year, or James Patterson, who I think this year had 97 books to his name, or his ghostwriters, or, you know.
So I want to talk about your new book.
Okay.
And your website describes Love and Other Consolation as an enchanting tale about innocence and devotion in a world where everything and everyone is for sale. So how do you manage to blend vice and innocence so easily in many of your writing?
It's a very innocent coming of age love story, but it's set in a brothel. So it's like coming of age, innocence, and this other thing that's going on. And I kind of liked that challenge of trying to create a very simple story, but it's, I describe it as, you know, it's a story of love that's all consuming in an environment of all consummation. And so it's, you know, it's actually a pretty, you know, PG rated book, maybe PG-13. It could be far more salacious, but I think sort of the inner workings of the human heart are much more interesting than just sort of the physical, biological geometry.
So before we get to the bordello, and I think you have a question to start.
Well, you know, I'm really intrigued by this main character, a 12-year-old mixed-blood Chinese boy named Ernest Young. He's too old for the hope of being adopted, and he ends up in America being raffled off at the 1909 Pacific World Exposition. Shocking storyline, really, and just how the book opens with the death of his baby sister. To me, historical fiction gives us such an ability to capture the past while using that imaginary place. I'm wondering why you choose to focus on historical fiction. What about it intrigues you?
I like the complexity, honestly. I mean, we live in a world of 140 characters on Twitter, and there's no opportunity for a deep dive, and everything is binary, and everything is like good or bad. And everybody's, you know, this aching combination of joy and sadness and success and failure. And historical fiction, we can look back and we can really take a broad yet still deep, you know, inquiry into why we behave the way we do, why we change as a culture. And we don't change that quickly. And so I like looking at the time period where, as a country, we were throwing off this veneer of a frontier country, you know, and, mm-hmm. and we're trying to embrace industry and technology and modern culture. But at the same time, you know, in Seattle, it had a vibrant red light district that was funded by the mayor and the police chief at the same time as women are fighting for the right to vote. Mm-hmm. This confluence of really complex things. And when you rub those things together, a lot of sparks fly.
It's based on a true story. They did raffle off this 12-year-old boy. How did you find that? Or how did that story come to you?
Yeah, you know, I was researching the 1909 fair in Seattle, really Seattle's forgotten World's Fair. And they had all these themed days, and every day had a theme and a giveaway. So they had a Butte Anaconda Day, and they raffled off 3,000 copper ingots. And then they had Washington Children's Day, where they raffled off a boy. And he was donated through the Washington Children's Receiving Home. There was an ad in the Seattle Times for the giveaway and comments from the director of the receiving home, a man named L.J. Covington. And it's just a flash moment of where we are as a culture. Something like that 100 years ago was totally acceptable, actually seen as maybe something beneficial to the child. Now, you know, we're sort of aghast to that. And why has our culture changed? And is it better? Is it worse? All those things.
Well, and it was just 100 years ago, you say, so we're not changing all that fast.
No, it's a generation and a half.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that far in the past.
And I think a lot of people don't know about the indentured service positions of a lot of Chinese and Japanese. And it wasn't thought of as particularly wrong in the early 1900s in Seattle. Did you do some additional research about that in the Seattle area or?
Yeah, I looked at this concept of, the term was blackbirding, and it started in the mid to late 1800s, where a lot of immigrants that came from China or from the Philippines or from Japan, sometimes they came to be a migrant worker. And sometimes they were just kind of kidnapped and thrown on a boat and then sold into servitude. And that was quietly accepted up until the League of Nations banned it after World War I, this practice of taking indigenous people and pressing them into service overseas. And in some cases, to be fair, these people were sold by their own families, especially women who didn't have a lot of perceived value in certain cultures. And if you happen to have an extra daughter and you couldn't marry her off, it seemed like an equitable arrangement to sell her to someone. I was curious, but also equally disturbed that this was just a common practice. And it was, we kind of look the other way in the United States, that this was understood, that this is what is done.
What did you choose to do historical fiction as opposed to a nonfiction book? I recognize that there's a whole lot more liberty that fiction offers you, but sounds like there was plenty of fodder for a nonfiction work.
Yeah, the thing about nonfiction is you can be super academic or you can be, you can almost do narrative nonfiction and write it as a novel. And if I'm going to do that, I might as well write the novel because then I can play with history a little bit and I can have different characters walk on the stage. And so I like that latitude. Also, I sometimes feel super self-conscious as I'm writing about history. And so I am writing a novel and I do tons of research, but I would hate to be regarded as the ultimate authority on a certain subject because I think all historians, we're making assumptions. You plot certain points and they point to a conclusion, but you never really know.
Ultimately, Jamie, you are a romantic. You can't get away from that.
Yeah.
The fact that your books are number one in every book group across the country has to do with the fiction aspect of it. I think if you wrote a nonfiction book about Chinese immigration, it's not going to be there.
No.
Yeah, you get these vivid characters that you can bring to life in such compelling ways. We really want to follow their saga based on how they're unfolding, and fiction gives you so much more liberty there.
It does. I mean, you're not going to read an academic university press book on a historical subject and get a love story or get a complicated family story out of it, and that's the wrinkle you can add.
I'm wondering about imagination. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about all of these characters that come from historical background. It makes it so much more accessible history. What do you think is happening to imagination and just to reading in general? Because it can take us to a whole nother world and in a way that somebody can get very lost in your words and your writing. But I don't know that we're spending as much time reading, at least in a deep dive, yeah, as we are on the surface of skimming an incredible amount of information out there.
Yeah, I really worry that as a society, we're becoming black belt level consumers of media, where every moment, and I do it the same, it's like I don't have a quiet moment in my brain. I'm either reading, watching something, listening to a podcast, like any dead moment, I'm filling it with stimulus.
Not to mention self-promotion, book tours,
sure,
PR,
mm-hmm,
tweeting, mm-hmm, you know.
Yeah, but even like if I walk the dogs to the river, I want to listen to a podcast as I'm walking that mile, and I really should unplug and just listen to my own thoughts and ruminate on characters and speak to my imaginary friends and be creative. And I think we're great at mainlining shows on Netflix, and maybe we need to spend a little bit more time creating art and poetry and music and doing some of these other things.
And digesting it, too, through the act of reading. I'm really curious what's happening to the novel. I mean, how much time do we allot ourselves to sit down and read versus how much time we allot ourselves to sit down and consume a storyline mm-hmm, on Netflix, for instance?
Yeah. I my hunch is that we are living in the golden age of long format television, and ultimately that's going to hurt literature, books, you know, of any genre, that people will be consuming fewer printed stories and mainlining more visual stories on in a digital format. I worry about that because it's a downward cycle. The more people consume those, the less they create, and there's less creative stuff to be consumed. So eventually we're going to be reduced to everyone just reading one, you know, the same book that'll, you know, be done in a movie rehashed 12 times like we're seeing.
I'm always surprised when I teach in class how little information my students know about the immediate past. Mm. So when you're talking about the boarding schools, our book festival, several of the books talk about Indian boarding schools in Canada.
Yeah.
And people don't know about that. And that is not ancient history.
And it's also, I mean, there's two things that's going on. I think psychologists or sociologists call that like the 15-year gap or the 20-year gap before we were born. There's just like this blank period where we don't know a lot about. But also with some heavy subjects, especially like Indian boarding schools, there's almost an embargo in the news about writing about these things. And so there were a lot of stories that went untold. And I think it's, you know, it's a great opportunity for writers, especially novelists, to go back and breathe life into these stories and kind of illuminate people so they have at least a cultural perspective.
But isn't it wonderful? Have you been to Heart Mountain since they've read?
Yeah.
It's so informative and interesting.
Great interpretive.
And again, it's a part of our culture, recent history, that a lot of people didn't know about.
Yeah, I mean, people are still alive who spent 4 or 5 years in Japanese internment camps. It's not like the French Revolution, you know, a couple hundred years ago. I mean, this is really current and affects people's families today. And so I think it's important to grow up and look at our history through something other than a second grade lens and say, yeah, mm-hmm, Christopher Columbus was a complex person. He was really bad. He was really possibly good. And he was both of those things at the same time. And it's okay to think that, as opposed to saying he was all evil or he was all good.
Let's go to something fun. Let's go to the brothel.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, but if I was a 12-year-old boy living in the brothel, Madame Flora's brothel, that was like pretty dang fun.
Yeah, it's an interesting place to spend a little time as a borderline pubescent child. Yeah, it's interesting. Much of the story, you know, the story is a split narrative. So part of it takes place in the 60s and part of it takes place in, you know, 1909, 1910. And in that earlier narrative, much of the story is spent in Seattle's red light district, in a brothel known as the Tenderloin, run by a woman named Florence Nettleton, who is better known as Madame Flora, who I don't really mention it in my author's note because I didn't have a ton of information on her, but she was a real person. And I did do an event in Seattle a couple of weeks ago, and an elderly gentleman came up to me and said, I knew Madame Flora.
Oh, wild.
And I was like, do tell. Let's talk. And his father ran a furniture store that was in that area of Seattle, and his dad's furniture store actually provided all the beds to the brothel. And he and his little brother would go when they made furniture deliveries and kind of run around and meet the ladies that worked there. And they all baked cookies for the ladies that worked there, baked cookies for people in the neighborhood, businesses, and would always give cookies, tens of cookies, to he and his brother. And he said, my mom would never let me eat the brothel cookies.
Do you collect a lot of in-person interviews for data for your work?
I do. With this one, it was a little hard because it was just beyond the range where I could interview people that had first, you know, that had been there in 1909. But I do interview people related to the subject matter. And so there was a woman in Seattle who was an expert on Seattle's red light district. She had been on CNN. She is kind of an armchair historian. I contacted her. I met her for coffee in Seattle. Her name was Maggie. It turned out that Maggie was also, in addition to being an expert on Seattle's red light district, she was a high-paid escort. She was also a public librarian. She changed my opinion of escorts and librarians in the exact same meeting. The Seattle library system needs to give her a raise, yeah. I think.
Well, they do have that open book image of their library Seattle, isn't it?
Very, very progressive library, I guess. Yeah, so I find people who are experts on the subject matter, and then I interview them and take copious notes.
When Earth is in this brothel, he falls in love with two girls. And so we have a little love triangle on top of all of that. And two wildly different girls, too.
Yeah. And they're both fairly strong and independent, you know, kind of a product of their time and especially their environment. And half the story takes place in the 60s, and Ernest is married to a woman named Gracie her health is failing. And much of the story is a mystery of wondering who he ended up with. As a young boy, he truly fell in love with two different people who were quite different. And you're left wondering, who did he end up with and why? What was the sacrifice? What was the decision to bring him to that moment?
You mentioned it jumps back from 1910. Actually starts in 1902, I think, mm-hmm. is when Ernst's mother puts him on a boat mm-hmm. to come across to the 60s. So we have a 50-year time span. What's that like jumping back and forth? And do you have to be careful as a writer not to get anachronistic information?
You really have to be careful that you're staying in the time period with jargon and stuff that's going on pop culture wise and just kind of the decorum of the two different ages. But also it gives you a sense of how much hasn't changed in 50 years mm-hmm. where you'd think we've just totally changed as a society. And in many ways, we're slow to change.
Jamie, would you mind sharing a passage from the book?
Sure. Let's see. This is a little ways into the book. We've met the character of Ernest. We've met Maisie. We've met Fawn. It's clear there's a simple affection between them all. But what's going on at this point in the book is Madame Flora has decided to take all of her working girls and all of her servants to the last day of the World's Fair in 1909. This was known as Hurrah Day, and the whole city came out for this grand closing ceremonies. And Ernest has saved his money because he knows there's a captive hot air balloon, and he pays for the last ride of the night. And he floats up 1,500 feet above the World's Fair, and he's looking down on these beautiful reflecting pools and these new buildings that have been constructed, and they're all deckled with electric lights. This gorgeous vista, and then the lights go out. Ernest closed his eyes, and when he opened them again, the world had fallen into darkness. The lights had been put out to mark the official closing of the fair. The lit buildings, the street lamps, every bulb had vanished into pitch black, as if the world below them had fallen away, swallowed whole. He heard the crowd for a moment, then an aching silence, followed by a lone bugler who played a sad melody. You know my secret, Maisie said, and now I know yours. Ernest sniffled and held his emotions in check as he thought about happier moments. Fawn's oatmeal cookies, her warm, soft kisses, lying next to Maisie on that soft bed of clover, trading bites of crisp, sugar-coated apples. He tried to take those new memories and the broken pieces of his heart, rearrange them, somehow mend them together, even as his eyes adjusted to the darkness, and he strained to find definition in the murky world he was floating in. That's when he felt Maisie slide closer, wrapping the blanket around his shoulders. He could feel her warmth through plush, supple layers of fabric. She smelled like perfume and flowers and happiness. Ernest's heart raced as the gondola drifted, and they heard wistful strains wafting up from the crowd below. 50,000 people, 100,000 singing Auld Lang Syne, and surrounded by emptiness, gently rocking to the sound of melancholy, Ernest and Maisie sang along in whispers. He turned as she leaned closer and her arm slipped into a quiet embrace. He felt her hair on his cheek, the softness of her breath as his hands found her waist. He was awed at her touch and what the human heart is capable of feeling, such sadness, such shame, but such acceptance, such joy, all at the same time. The balloon swayed and he said, "Steady, I've got you." "I've got you too," she whispered. Then he looked down, noticing flickering lights, the city on the horizon. He marveled at the beautiful, challenging world beneath them, so far away, and he thought, "I wonder if the best thing any of us can hope for in life is a soft place to land." He felt Maisie nod, and then the night exploded, their ears filled with booming echoes of cannon reports as fireworks burst all around them. Blooming peonies and chrysanthemums filled the darkness. Star-like shells rose to greet them, flashing like comets, painting the sky with swashes of sparkling, flickering, glowing embers that slowly rained back down in a beautifully arranged marriage of fire and gravity. Ernest closed his eyes for a moment and could still see the shimmering display. He could hear the rhythmic booming cadence of explosions. Then he opened his eyes again and it was like they were standing in the heart of a snow globe, a blizzard of white hot stars as far as the eye could see. He felt Maisie's hand on his chest. "See," she said, smiling in the flashing, waning colors. "This life, your life, my life, the happy memories, the sad stories, the hellos, the goodbyes, you, me, Fawn, everything is connected, always." Ernest felt her words more than he heard them, and then he sensed the balloon begin to slowly descend beneath the canopy of pyrotechnics, sinking into the darkness.
Beautiful. Lovely. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you.
So, cinematic.
And then just the description of just wanting a soft place to land.
Right.
I mean, you've got such a theme of relationships and connections going on through these characters.
Hollywood, are they knocking on your door?
My first book, Hotel on the Corner, Bitter and Sweet. We had lots of offers on the film option. We finally have optioned it. It's in pre-production. I actually worked on the first two drafts of the screenplay.
And then they yanked it out of your hands after that?
Well, you know, it was, I have to write books. That's kind of, I'm happy to, with my level of involvement, I'm extremely fortunate. But I'm also kind of happy to hand it off to, there's a screenwriting duo that we've selected to work with. You know, I've met with them. I think they're awesome. I'm happy to have them kind of carry the ball. I'm very aware that, you know, with the script, there's multiple versions of it, and that could take up a lot of my time, and it did take up most of my summer, but I'm ready to get back to other things. But it's a different art form for sure, you know? I mean, it's, instead of writing 400 pages, you're writing 90, and so the process, it's like doing the blueprint for a house. You're just doing the blueprint. You're not putting up the drywall yourself and installing the plumbing and painting the walls and putting on the roof as you do with a novel, where you do everything. And so there's an expedience to it, but the people that do it well, I mean, there's a reason why they make mega bucks. It is a separate art.
I'm curious what calls you to writing. You say you're meant to write books. What is
isn't
that?
Your degree in visual arts?
Yeah, my degree.
If I recall.
I used to be a interventional cardiologist for many years. I'm just joking.
Like, tell us more.
You know, that wasn't challenging enough. My degree is in art and design, so I kind of had that whole other career, but I was always writing on the side, and I want to write all the things. And so I was grateful for the opportunity to work on the screenplay, but I'm also, you know, I want to work on a graphic novel script, and I want to work on some essays, and I want to work on a young adult novel. And there's I just pitched a short story, kind of a post-election dystopian short story for a collection that Sherman Alexie is putting together. And so there's all these things I want to do. And I'd like to go back and get better at screenwriting as well.
Sounds like whatever form it takes, writing is your calling.
Yeah. I'm even going back to poetry because I love Uh-oh. Poetry. I know.
That sells well, though. So if you decide to get out of
it. Right. Does it?
Yeah. You're right.
Good to know.
Wait a minute. Yeah. Oh, maybe it doesn't.
I wrote so much poetry in my youth, and I'm so terrible at it. But because of that, I just want to keep doing it and figure it out. And there are certain poets that I just love their work. And so I've been inspired to.
Jamie, that's not the direction. Poets become novelists. I've never heard of novelists becoming poets.
I know. I was like, can we have a second show just to chat poetry?
Yeah. I'm going to move into this other world.
Love it. I'm curious, too. What brought you to Montana and why Great Falls?
The Witness Protection Program.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, I don't talk about it much, but I witnessed a murder. No, I actually said that to my neighbor one time, and he's a retired U.S. Marshal, and he's like, oh, no, they're all over the High Line. Like, they're here. So
I actually know
really?
People that are in the Witness Protection Program from back east, and they don't talk about it.
Yeah, it's a good place to get lost. You can hide here. Before Montana, I did grow up in the Seattle area, but before mm-hmm. Montana, I was working and living in Hawaii, and I missed the mainland. You know, I loved Hawaii, but I missed the seasons. And, you know, there was a job offer in Great Falls at the time, and it was intriguing, and I really liked the thought of Montana. I'd been to Montana before and loved it, and I also knew, I didn't know, but I hoped that in Montana I could carve out part of my life and have a little more time to write. And that was really one of the big reasons that I came here. I've been here 17 years. I've been here for a while, but I came with the hope and the aspiration that I would get some writing done.
Mm, it looks like it delivered.
Yeah, and it's delivered.
Working. And I love the idea that you're living here in Great Falls and you're not writing about the big lonely ranch life, or you're not writing the typical Montana story,
boy. Right? Yeah, you know, there's canon that's been done. You know, Jim Harrison and James Welch and Tom McGuane. I mean, people mm-hmm. far better than me have rendered this landscape beautifully.
And none of them have Chinese grandparents, though.
Right, right. Yeah. So you know, they write their own experience, and I have a different experience, and so I definitely go down that rabbit hole.
Thank you so much for being with us, Jamie. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And I will tell our audience, you can easily find Jamie Ford and his books at jamieford.com. Is that correct? That's
that
a pretty
correct.
Easy thing to get a website with just your name.
Yeah, that was back in that was early on. And you have to be careful, because if you Google me, there is a Playboy model named Jamie Ford. So you're going to see something else entirely.
But she was a terrible writer.
Yes, right. Exactly.
Thank you, Jamie.
You bet.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.